In the name of God, the Beneficent, the Merciful, the Creator and the Sustainer of the Universe, peace and blessings upon His servant and messenger Muhammad forever. Amin. I bear witness that there is no God worthy of worship except the one true God, and I bear witness that Muhammad is the messenger and servant of God. As is my fashion, I greet you with the universal greetings of peace, a greeting that has been used by all of the prophets from Abraham through to Prophet Muhammad, peace and blessings be upon them all. Assalamu alaikum, which means peace be unto you. Today we have our 20th program in our series dealing with the social system of Islam. We'll be continuing our discussion with part two of Muslim Women in History. I'm your host, Hamid Rashid, and I have joining me on the program as usual Dr. Jamal Badawi of St. Mary's University. Brother Jamal, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam.
Could I have you just very quickly highlight the main points that we touched on in our first program dealing with Muslim women in history?
Certainly. In the very early part of the program, we just continued the discussion of the acceptance of the witness of a Muslim woman, and we've gone into some finer details that I hope would clarify that issue. But the focus of the program really was the actual examples of Islamic history of prominent Muslim women. And it was quite clear that they were quite involved in many respects. Question was raised about Muslim women involvement in belief and faithfulness. And we have indicated that the very first person who became Muslim was not a man, was a woman, yeah. Khadija, the wife of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and how he supported him by her soothing, by her kindness, by her property, throughout his lifetime, which was 25 years, where he lived alone with or had Khadija as his only wife at that time. And as a result, we talked again about how recognition was given to Khadija in the words of God, as communicated by God, and the recognition given by Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, extending even to being very faithful to her memory after her death. We have given also examples of some Muslim women who became believers irrespective of what their fathers, brothers, or even husbands were. And in some cases, even they preferred to separate from their husbands or migrate and leaving their place of birth and their families in pursuit of their freedom of practice of their faith. And finally, we touched briefly on the case of women not only becoming believers or standing on their own, but the case where they were even subjected, like men, to all kind of hurt and torture and suffering. And again, we mentioned that women scored another first in the fact that the first martyr in Islam after Prophet Muhammad came was a woman, not a man. That's Sumayya, the mother of Ammar ibn Yasir, who was stabbed by a spear, or you know, through the process of torture that she was going through. We gave examples of women who participated in very dangerous assignments, like Asma, who was a teenager at that time. She was a daughter of Abu Bakr, and she used to provide the supplies and news to the Prophet, despite the fact that people were seeking his head and the head of his companion.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, in addition to the Muslim examples of the Muslim women that we discussed in our first program who achieved prominence in areas of faith, is there any example of Muslim women playing crucial roles in Dawah and the propagation of the faith?
Well, first of all, it should be indicated that the obligation of a Muslim to communicate the message of Islam or to invite others to it is a matter which is not just a privilege or right, just like seeking knowledge. It is rather a duty and responsibility. And there is no reference that we can find in the Quran or prophetic tradition that exclude women from this very laudable act. Indeed, historically speaking, if we were focusing on that particular angle, we find that, for example, Urwa, the daughter of Abdul Muttalib, used to publicly support the Prophet even in the most critical times. Mm-hmm. Not only this, she was quite outspoken in urging people to believe in Prophet Muhammad and to give him their support. Another example is of another prominent woman by the name of Umm Salim, who was also the mother of a very prominent companion of the Prophet. He was still a small boy at that time. His name is Anas ibn Malik. And that woman, after the death of her husband, a rich man came to her. His name was Abu Talha, to seek her hand in marriage.
Yes.
He was a very rich and noble person. And she told him, well, Abu Talha, a man like you should not be turned down. However, I am sorry, because you are an unbeliever and I am a believer, and it is not permissible for me in Islam to get married to an unbeliever. And then she told him, Abu Talha, do you realize that the God you worship has grown from earth? Because he used to worship a kind of image or a statue which was made of wood. So did you know that your God that you worship was grown or came out from the earth? He said, yes. She said, don't you feel ashamed of praying to something that comes out of the earth? Then he started telling her, well, how about the gold and silver? That means he wanted to tempt her to marry him because he's rich.
Yes.
He said, I have no need for your gold or silver. But if you turn to the truth and you become a believer, you become a Muslim, I'll get married to you. I don't want even a marital gift or mahar. Your belief would be my mahar, would be my marriage gift. In fact, he did turn to faith and became a very good Muslim afterwards. So that again showed another activity of propagation of faith, even on the personal level, when even the future of the woman as a possible wife is at stake from very good and personable individual. But still, faith was very essential to her. So she spread the faith via this means.
Yes.
Another interesting example also is the lady named Umm Shariq, that even in the most critical moments in Islamic history, where Muslims were persecuted and tortured, sometimes to death, she never hesitated to go around secretly visiting other women, inviting them to the truth of Islam and asking them to give up all these pagan practices that they used to have. And she did succeed with many of them. So as far as involvement, it took a variety of forms, but women were part and parcel of invitation of people to the truth of Islam.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, how about in the area of knowledge and scholarship? Were women distinguishing themselves in this area as well, in Islamic history?
Yes, indeed. In various points of Islamic history, this has been shown. But perhaps one of the most prominent examples is Aisha, wife of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, that she was regarded as a very important source of prophetic tradition. And by the way, that might relate back to the question we discussed in a previous program about women being witness. This point was brought to my attention by my wife. I was discussing that topic this morning, and she mentioned that if a woman is accepted as a source of prophetic tradition, which is the basis of Islamic law, how could her witness be rejected in other minor disputes?
Yes.
So Aisha was one of those great sources of prophetic tradition, and she's not the only one. Umm Salama was a source. Other women also were sources of prophetic tradition. Indeed, Abu Musa al-Ash'ari, one of the prominent scholars of Islam in early days, one time put it very humbly, as narrated in Tabaqat ibn Sa'd. And he said, whenever we, he meant scholars, whenever we had any complex problem pertaining to Islamic law, we used to go to Aisha and ask her, and always we found that she had some knowledge of it.
Mm-hmm.
So she used to do what is called today fatwa. She used to give verdicts in matters of faith because of her deep knowledge and scholarship of Islamic teaching. This is not the only example. Maybe I'll just give you one more example for brevity of time. Another lady was known as Asma bint Yazid. And this woman was an Ansari woman from Medina. And when Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, migrated from Mecca to Medina, She made bay'ah, or oath of allegiance, to him, and she learned a lot from him, and she proved herself to be a scholar in her own right. Indeed, it was narrated that many future scholars actually learned through her. She was like a professor, if you will, if you give the title of today's title. Really, she was really a professor and educator to many other important jurists. So many bright examples like this, that the question of knowledge and scholarship, as far as Islam is concerned, pure Islam, there's no barrier whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And there have been no barriers.
Well, now, how about in the areas of social service and involvement in charitable activities?
Well, in fact, the area of charitable activities from an Islamic perspective is perhaps one of the most suitable areas where women can excel men even, because of the nature of compassion, kindness and concern, self-sacrifice. They can do a much better job on this. In fact, if you go back to the early, that's the perfect, near perfect era of Islamic practice, the early days, you will find very touching examples. I'll give you one. After the death of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and when Islam spread in different lands and the wealth came in, Abdullah ibn Zubair, who was a relative of Aisha, the former wife of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, he brought her 100,000 dirham. Dirham was a kind of coin or currency they used. 100,000. Immediately, she distributed the entire amount to the poor and needy. That day, Aisha was fasting. And as you know, in Islam, you break your fast only after sunset. There is no food or drink. When the sunset came and she wanted to break her fast, she just discovered that she didn't have any food at home to break her fast on. So you see the self-sacrifice, that she didn't have enough food even to break her fast, and still that mass wealth that she received was all distributed to the poor and needy. What could be a more noble example of self-sacrifice and concern for the poor and the needy? Another very interesting example took place also in the lifetime of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and the heroine in that one was Fatima, his daughter.
Yes.
As you know, Fatima was so close to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, that they used to call her daddy's daughter. He used to love her so much. And she was married to his cousin, Ali. Mm-hmm. Ali was a poor person. He didn't have that much. And one time, Ali told Fatima, listen, the situation of Muslims improved now a little bit financially. And your father is the Prophet himself. He has, you know, control over all these things. Why don't you go to him and ask him to assign a servant to us to help us? After all, I keep carrying water on my back. My back is aching. So Fatima responded to her husband, Ali. She said, and me too. I keep grinding the grains. Of course, they didn't have the bread nicely packed in plastic covers and all that, or plastic bag. She said, I also keep grinding the grains until my hands were full of blisters. He said, all right, why don't you go to the Prophet and ask him to help us, to give us a servant or something. They went to Prophet Muhammad. She went first on her own. Mm-hmm. But she felt shy to ask, to make that request. She went back home to her husband, Ali. And then she told him, she said, all right, let's go together to the Prophet. So both of them went to the Prophet and they explained to him that, you know, if he can just give them some relief and assign somebody to serve them. What was his answer, Prophet Muhammad? He said, I cannot provide you with this service while there are so many Muslims, particularly people who were known as Ahl al-Suffa, while there are so many Muslims whose tummies are aching from hunger. Mm-hmm. You compare that with the behavior of many rulers today who spend and squander millions of dollars just in the wedding of their son or daughter. Here is the Prophet who have command over all that wealth refusing to give or assign a servant to his own beloved daughter, despite the fact that they badly needed it. And then what did the Prophet say to them? He said, instead of a servant, could I teach you something And then he told them that after prayer you should make this supplication, and then when you go to bed you should make this kind of supplication. He taught them some special type of supplications and prayers to God. And both Fatima and her husband Ali reported that they never left this practice of repeating this, which showed that, again, this spiritual elation and worship was better in the mind of the Prophet, as well as his daughter Fatima and her husband Ali, than simply having a more comfortable and luxurious type of life. So there's another interesting incident, if I just may add this quickly. Not only were women participating in charity in a sense of just, you know, helping the poor, but some of them even participated in what you might call today consumer protection.
Yes.
In the days of Umar, the second caliph after the Prophet, one of the ladies was known as Umm al-Shifa, the daughter of Abdullah. And that woman was so much wise and liked that Umar used to give her, or give a lot of weight to her opinion. And at one time it was reported that he appointed her in the marketplace to supervise the buying and selling, to make sure that nobody is cheating, which you might call today, like I said, something like a public office and consumer protection, if you will.
Well, now, we touched on this point I'm going to raise briefly last time, and that is in the involvement of Muslim women in war efforts. Can you tell us something about the involvement of the Muslim women in the early war efforts?
Well, it is quite evident historically from a variety of sources that Muslim women did volunteer, indeed, in many of the battles that Muslims had to go through to defend their faith and themselves. But more particularly in services like what you call logistical services, providing food and drink for the fighting army, nursing those who are wounded, and carrying them back to the city, or providing whatever help they could to support the fighting men. It is interesting to notice that in the most authentic collection of prophetic tradition in Bukhari, there is a chapter there about the women's participation in the battlefield or in warfare. In Bukhari and Ahmad, it was reported by way of example that a lady by the name of Al-Rabi'a bint Ma'wud said that we used to go in the battlefield with the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, providing drink for the people, serving them, and taking the injured and the dead back to Medina. In another narration in Muslim and Ahmad and Ibn Majah, another lady by the name of Umm Atiyah, which was an Ansari woman, she also narrated that I went in 7 battles with Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and then she gave similar description of the kind of duties she performed, like looking after their supplies and luggage, making food for them, nursing those who are injured, and looking after those who have been disabled as a result of the battle. Even Aisha, the wife of the Prophet herself, peace be upon him, was reported to have carried water in a water bag. They used to have a kind of leather water bag on her back, along with another woman, Umm Ayman, to give drink to people in the front line in the battlefield. Another woman, Umayyah bint Qais al-Ghafariyya, again, when she was very young, about a teenager, at the age of 14, she made the oath of allegiance to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. And one time she came along with other women to him, and she told the Prophet, we would like to go out with you in the battlefield to take care of the injured and provide you with what you need. And the Prophet simply says, "Ala barakatillah," okay, come with the blessing of Allah. He did not object to their participation. These are only a few examples, but if you look into Islamic history, I could give you offhand a few more names beside those mentioned already, like Umm Salim, Nasiba bint Ka'b, Umm Sanan al-Aslamiyya, Layla al-Ghafariyya, Umm al-Dahhaq, Safiyya, daughter of Abdul Muttalib, Hamna bint Jahsh. There are literally dozens of them, and these are only the women who took lead, actually, in leading other women to support the fighting men. But it doesn't cover even all the rank and file of multitudes of Muslim women who provided the best help they could to the people in the battlefield.
Now, in the discussion thus far, you've indicated the involvement which might, I guess, be characterized more or less as being of logistical support.
That's right.
I wonder if perhaps there were occasions where Muslim women were actually involved, actually participated in the battlefield, who actually carried arms for self-defense.
Well, yes, there were examples of that. We mentioned before a name of a very prominent woman, Umm Salim, who was married to Abu Talha. We just mentioned about her early in the program. In the Battle of Hunayn, when Muslims were really in danger, that woman did not simply say, all right, I'll depend on men totally for protection. She herself made or obtained a dagger, and she put it, you know, on her waist, and she actually mentioned to her husband that if somebody gets close to me or try to violate me, I would not hesitate to use the dagger to defend myself. And when Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, heard about that, he didn't say, all right, you are only a woman, that you have no business in defense, leave it to us. He simply said, Umm Salim, that's mother of Salim, Allah have already protected us from the danger. But he did not really object to her after the fact, of course. He did not object that she was careful trying to defend herself. In the Battle of Uhud, another very serious battle when Muslims were really in grave danger, there was a moment where the tide was against the Muslim fighting army, and the pagans started attacking to reach the Prophet, Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and kill him and just get rid of all these difficulties that they had as a result of emergence of Islam. And at that moment, it was really a trying moment because Muslims, like I said, were really in a very critical position. One of the ladies by the name of Nasiba bint Ka'b, while she was providing this logistical support that we're talking about, she felt that there's a great deal of danger on the life of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. She threw everything and she took a sword and she started defending the Prophet, putting herself in the face of the pagans to protect the life of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. Indeed, the Prophet recognized her courage, and actually he mentioned after the battle that whenever I turned my face towards the right or left, there was this lady, Nasiba bint Ka'b, defending me along with other believers. In fact, it was reported that she received 12 injuries while defending Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him. I don't know how many women can have that kind of perseverance and courage to engage in that kind of battles. Early in the program, I think it was perhaps in the previous program, we mentioned the name of a lady, Asma bint Yazid, an Ansari woman who was a scholar in her own right. She was not only a scholar, in fact, she was also a woman who was very courageous, who participated in some battles. Many historians refer to her participation in the Battle of Yarmouk, initially to give water and nurse the injured among the Muslim fighting men. But at one point, when she was in danger, when the Roman army was attacking the Muslims, she took the poles of her tent, and it was reported that she succeeded to kill 9 of the enemy soldiers who tried to attack the Muslims, just using the pole of a tent. Similarly, we find that Safiya bint Abdul Muttalib was left in the Battle of Al-Khandaq, or the trench. And there was a man with them, Hassan ibn Thabit, to try to guard them. But at one point, she was in danger, and unbelievers started getting close, and she immediately used a pole like Asma used, and she got rid of him. So there are several examples of women being really in the very dangerous position of fighting, even, or participating in the battlefield.
Well, now, some people, some of our viewers might claim that many of the examples that we've been discussing in these past two programs would not be applicable to today, because they occurred in the very early days of Islam, when Muslims were weak and in grave danger, and perhaps this might have been an exceptional
circumstances.
Exceptional circumstances. Mm-hmm. How would you respond to somebody who took that view?
Well, to use that argument, for example, to say that a Muslim woman should be barred exclusively from the battlefield, even if she wanted to volunteer, does not seem to have any definite and solid support. We have already mentioned that the Prophet, peace be upon him, consented to that. But you're right, if in case you want really to raise the issue of the special dangers to which Muslims were exposed in the early days, then the same argument would be applicable to any other time after the time of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, where similar danger may arise. Mm-hmm. And indeed, in recent times, we hear also about the persecution of Muslims in a variety of places in the world, fighting internal oppressive regimes or external occupying forces, as we hear about the struggle, heroic struggle of Muslim women in Egypt, in Syria, in Afghanistan, in Iran. Well, in all of these cases, we find that the same danger did exist when you have tyrannical regimes and you have to really resist and try to overthrow this tyranny. So if we make an argument on the basis of danger, danger does not know any specific time or place. Whenever the danger arises, it is permissible. But it should be fair also to indicate that, unlike men, woman is not obliged, for example, to participate actually in the front line, in the battlefield. In other words, a woman cannot be, drafted in the Muslim army. That the primary responsibility falls on men. But to say that God relieved her from the duty of being drafted because God knows maybe she had a small infant at home to take care of, I mean, there might be all kinds of reasons why women in particular should be given special consideration. But to say that is one thing, and to say that women are prohibited from participating in war effort, if need be, is a different thing. Some people refer to a certain saying of Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, when women, for example, asked him whether they are obliged to engage in jihad or struggle in the path of God, meaning partly also participating in the battlefield. And his answer was, your jihad is a good pilgrimage. If you do pilgrimage, that's your jihad. But again, to say that does not mean that you can't participate. It simply means that if you're not able to, if you're not participating in the battlefield, God will give you as much reward as he gives to men if you do some other types of worship, like pilgrimage, for example. So it's a kind of compensating factor rather than prohibition. But in any case, one has to indicate that Islam does not require a woman, for example, to leave her infant at home simply to participate in the battlefield. Those who are able to should, if they wish, be allowed to participate, especially in logistical support, nursing, and other services of similar nature. So within the overall framework of Islam and Islamic teaching, there is no difficulty with that. I should mention, however, one text that some people might use again to say women should not participate, that a lady by the name of Umm Kabsha came to the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, as narrated in Ahmad, Abu Dawood, and Nasa'i, to take his permission to participate in the Battle of Hunayn. And it is narrated that the Prophet said, all right, I am afraid if I allow you that it becomes established practice. That was, for example, narrated in Al-Isaba, Fi Tamyiz al-Sahaba, reference that I mentioned earlier. But that even text does not simply mean that women should be forbidden from participating, but he simply perhaps was afraid that some people may interpret that as a regular pattern that Muslim may be forced even to participate and put their life in the line in the battlefield, even against their wish. Mm-hmm. So if we take this argument then in the totality of the picture, in view of the fact that the Prophet, peace be upon him, did allow this, did not object to that, did not have any specific clear-cut prohibition, in the fact that these things happened with the approval of the Prophet, peace be upon him, shows that even in the so-called most liberated issue, mm-hmm, of participation in the battlefield, Muslim women in early days were not barred from involvement and participation.
Mm-hmm. We'll have to leave it at that. That's our time for today. We want to thank you for watching. We want to invite you back next week. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you.
الله أكبر الله أكبر.
الله